From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a federal court order means the Michigan recount has begun.
The seal on the box is snipped open. There are little plastic ties. And then you pull out all the ballots and you start sorting them. You see who voted for which presidential candidate.
The price to upgrade Michigan's infrastructure for the 21st century, another $4 billion a year.
The point is that it's going to take us a long time to get it done. But if we don't decide to start today, it's going to be a heck of a lot more expensive tomorrow.
It's the 225th anniversary of Mozart's death, and we still don't know what killed him.
Mercury poisoning and tuberculosis to my favorite, trichinosis from eating raw pork. Syphilis, scarlet fever, you name it, he's been diagnosed with it.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been quite the legal whirlwind of lawsuits and early morning judicial rulings, but the Michigan recount began today. Local clerks working furiously to meet the order to hand count more than 4.8 million votes cast by Michiganders in the presidential election. The first recounts are happening in Oakland and Ingham counties. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is checking out the count at the Ingham County Fairgrounds. Rick, what's going on right now?
Right now, people are gathered around tables with stacks of ballots. It's tedious work that you need to go. You need to check the number of votes that were cast in a precinct before the seal on the box is snipped open. There are little plastic ties. And then you pull out all the ballots and you start sorting them. You see who voted for which presidential candidate. If there's a question, then someone can challenge the ballot, and then it goes into an envelope for elections officials to decide how to resolve the dispute at a later time at the end of this process. But other than that, it's quiet, steady, really rather tedious work.
And there are a lot of ballots from Ingham County to have to plow through. So how long will they be at it?
They hope to be done by tomorrow evening. They're going to go until 8 o'clock tonight. I think in Oakland County, they're going to go until 7 o'clock. And they're hoping to have their portion of it wrapped up tomorrow night. But, of course, as the week goes on, other counties will join in. Like, you know, tomorrow Wayne County will start. That they'll be counting ballots at Cobo Hall in Detroit. And the goal is to have everything wrapped up a week from today, just short of the federal deadline for alerting the government who Michigan's electors are, which we should say has already been done. Michigan's Trump electors have been identified, but there's still time to change it if for some reason, in the unlikely event that the recount turns up some massive shift of votes.
Rick, it took an order handed down very early this morning, very unusual timing.
Very early this morning.
Indeed, from federal judge Mark Goldsmith to get this thing up and running. But legal challenges aren't done yet, are they?
No, actually, tomorrow afternoon, there will be a hearing in the State Court of Appeals where a three-judge panel has actually combined the challenges to the recount that were filed by President-elect Trump's campaign, the state Republican Party, and Republican Attorney General Bill Schuette. And they're all making basically the same argument. They say that Jill Stein's request for a recount is frivolous. She got just 1% of the vote. She has no hope of making up like 2 million votes to take the lead. And so she really doesn't have standing to make this request because she can't change the result in her favor. And of course, the Stein campaign says, well, this isn't about changing the result. This is about testing Michigan's optical scan system for counting paper ballots.
But the order to hold the recount came from a federal judge based on federal constitutional law, right? So an order from a state appeals court could not overturn a federal judicial order.
Well, we will see how that plays out if the Court of Appeals decides to step in and try and stop the recount. But, you know, Judge Goldsmith didn't just order that the recount would begin at noon. He also ordered that it continue until it's done. It certainly seems like that would be perilous territory for a state court to step in and try and trump that.
And meantime, certainly there's a lot of attention throughout the state being paid to the possible cost to taxpayers in all of this, which we don't even know yet how high that'll go. And we know State Rep. Lisa Lyons is trying to address that.
Yeah, it's we don't know how much it's going to cost, but it's a pretty sure bet that the, you know, almost $1 million paid by the Stein campaign for the statewide recount won't cover it. What Lisa Lyons wants to do is to change Michigan's election law to say that if the election was decided by more than a certain percentage of the vote, then the party trying to that requests the recount has to pick up the entire cost and then apply that retroactively. Now, that does raise questions of constitutionality, of whether or not it violates contract rights, since the Stein campaign, you know, paid a check with the expectation that that would cover the cost of the recount. We will also see how that plays out.
And in the midst of all of this, we learned Mr. Trump is bringing his victory tour to Grand Rapids on Friday, just to kind of add some spice to everything.
Right now, Kent County will probably have its recount wrapped up by then. So maybe it'll be a double victory tour for Donald Trump in Michigan.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta checking out the recount happening right now at the Ingham County Fairgrounds. Thanks, Rick.
You bet.
Seems there isn't much we in America can agree on these days, but most of us are pretty well in sync on one thing. Citizens United stinks and needs to go. Citizens United is the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision that said it is okay for corporations or unions to spend as much money as they want to convince you to vote for or against a candidate. A Bloomberg Politics poll last year found 78% of us think this decision was not good for the country and it should be overturned. Now, that hasn't stopped progress on a bill that's been passed by our state Senate and is on track to get through the House, likely during this lame duck session. Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network calls Senate Bill 638 Citizens United on steroids. Craig, backers of this bill say, hey, we're just codifying Citizens United into Michigan law. What do you say to that?
That's been the line throughout this process, that we're just putting what happened in Citizens United into state law. But the fact is, when you look at Citizens United, what that court decision said, if you read through it, and it's very lengthy, so bring a bookmark if you're doing that. And then you look at what this bill does, it's different. I mean, the lawmakers who support this bill are trying to color in these lines in every way possible to give themselves an advantage when it comes to their fundraising and to give donors in Lansing an advantage. This bill, the main thing about this bill that should trouble voters in Michigan or people who live here, is that it specifically allows lawmakers to fundraise unlimited amounts to super PACs from interest groups. I mean, that's what this bill does. At the federal level, if a federal official wants to raise money to a super PAC that supports the official, there's a $5,000 cap on what they can personally solicit. In this bill, specifically, it says they can raise unlimited amounts.
So I'm going to quote from Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry, as he talked about Senate Bill 638 and how he sees this could work. So here's his quote. It means, you could go to the Ku Klux Klan, ask them to give $1 million to the Committee for the Protection of Cute Puppies, with the understanding that the Cute Puppy Committee would give it to your campaign and nobody would ever have to know. Is that pretty much sum it up as far as what Senate Bill 638 would do?
I think he's getting at the core of this bill, but this is about super PACs specifically, so it's not about candidates' campaigns, and that's kind of how these lines get blurred. Citizens United set up this system where corporations and labor groups there are no limitations on what they can spend independently of candidates. So the question before the country in the years after this decision is, what is independent? What is independent spending of a candidate? This bill in Michigan is going to make independent very, very small. Like, super PACs are going to be able to work very closely with candidates. So what does that do? If there are no limitations on super PAC spending and candidates can work very closely with super PACs, it makes our campaign contribution limits mean less and less. I mean, Citizens United and previous court decisions, justices have said that we need campaign contribution limits on direct giving to candidates because there's a risk of corruption. But this super PAC independent spending has been set aside as something separate. But if a lawmaker can go and say, hey, can you give $1 million to the super PAC that supports me? To me, there is a huge risk of corruption in that.
And as you point out in your recent editorial in the Detroit Free Press, Michigan's transparency and accountability laws, here we are ranked last in the country. So 50th out of 50. And I can clearly tell from your editorial, you don't feel this is going to help a bit.
No, this isn't going to help a bit. And it goes, you know, when we compare our laws to what other states do, this is another example of where we differ, and it comes down on the bad side from what other states are doing. In other states, they've set up larger barriers between super PACs and candidates than this bill is going to set up. You know, at the federal level, as I talked about, there's a cap on what a lawmaker can solicit to a super PAC that supports himself or herself. This bill doesn't have those things, and it's worse than what's been put in law in other states.
Who is behind Senate Bill 638?
It's sponsored by Dave Robertson, who's a Senate Republican. Arlen Meekhoff, the Senate Majority Leader, has been a very outspoken supporter of this bill. In Gongwer, which is a Capitol newsletter, he said his spokesperson said that this is a very important bill to him to get done in lame duck, which was kind of interesting to me because of everything the state is facing, the Flint water crisis, the energy overhaul that's before the legislature, that this bill is very important to the Senate Majority Leader. It's just interesting.
Has it not been fairly quiet as it's made its way through? Now here we are in these final weeks of lame duck.
Yeah, it's been very quiet. I mean, it passed the Senate in 2015, so that was almost a year ago. And now the expectation is, and supporters have stated, that this bill is going to get taken up here in the last few days. It could be this week. It will most likely be next week, the last week of session.
And how much opposition to Senate Bill 638 can be found in the House? And especially, are there Republicans who are against it?
I mean, that's the question. Jack Lessenberry, in his piece, which is a very good piece, he quoted Tim Grimmel saying that Tim Grimmel, the House Minority Leader, thinks all Democrats will vote against it, and he suspects some Republicans will vote against it. So it's just a matter of how many House Republicans will oppose it if it will get through the House. But as we've seen before on these campaign finance bills, they usually find their way through one way or another.
Greg Mauger, Michigan Campaign Finance Network, talking to us about Senate Bill 638, which, again, he so colorfully calls Citizens United on steroids. Always great to talk with you, Craig. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunity is the next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
Refugees in this country, in this state, face many challenges, cultural, linguistic, economic. And being a refugee and a teenager poses its own set of problems. How can those who serve the refugee community give teenage refugees new tools to navigate their new world? One way, giving them a safe place to practice problem solving alongside other teens who've come through similar situations. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is doing that in mid-Michigan. Erica Brown-Binion is the executive director of the Refugee Development Center in Lansing. She's with us now. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Being a teen is really tough under the best of circumstances. In your work, what have you seen are some of the unique challenges faced by teenage refugees?
Yeah, teenage refugees, just like other teenagers, are trying to fit in. And they are in a completely new world, new language, new social patterns, different customs, different traditions. So as these students are trying to fit into the new culture that they're experiencing, they're also trying to figure out what their old culture, how that fits in too. So just like other teenagers, it's very challenging to navigate a brand new social world and kind of be thrust into it and have to figure it out, you know. So they seek advice from other students and other peers. They're around, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lansing refugee culture, but we have about 2,000 students in the Lansing School District who are from refugee and immigrant cultures. So it represents a large portion of the population. And these kids are fitting in and becoming part of, you know, the regular fabric of this community, and we're really proud to have them here.
And you've been using something called Peace Game to help make that happen. What is Peace Game?
Peace Game is a really special program that we have in partnership with the Michigan State University Residential College of Arts and Humanities. So we've been offering this program for a couple of years, and in a nutshell, what it does is give students the opportunity to kind of experience real-life scenarios and problem solve. So at first the students identify issues that are crises in their lives, you know, hunger, poverty, displacement as they've experienced it. So the students are really the leaders of this program, and they identify crises that they might have had or see in their life, and then they role play them out, and they have to be the leaders problem solving. So they're really teaching us how to solve some of these problems that the world grapples with every day.
Is this actually a board game?
The game itself does not start as a board game, but the students create it. So their job is, through art with a leader who is experienced in clay, developed this rectangular board, and they identified three countries that kind of represented some of the challenges that they might have in a regular world. So you have the city life, you have the rural life, you have in between that, and in the middle of that is the ocean. So the students kind of created this all on their own, what the world might look like in this fake reality. And then what they are assigned is leaders of each of those three countries. So you have like the prime minister, the mayor, you might have the activists, you might have the problem maker. And each of these roles, they play it out daily as they come to this program and have to work through crises that they have identified. So the board game itself is something that the students actually created and then utilize each week to play.
Now, a lot of us are familiar with games like, so let's say like Risk, where the goal is to basically rule the world. What is the goal of the peace game? I guess, how do you as a player know when you are, let's use air quotes here, winning?
Right, and that's what makes this program so special, because it's not about solving the problem perfectly so that there is one winner. I mean, really, they are working on really complex topics, and having the capability to solve those problems is what's really most important. So coming together, communicating effectively, working through problems that might be really challenging but not fighting through them, and having peaceful solutions. So that's where peace game comes from.
So if you've come up with a solution that everyone can agree on, maybe it doesn't give everyone everything they want, but there's a sense of, all right, we've got ourselves a plan, then in a sense you've won at peace game.
Exactly. It's the idea of winning through compromise and finding some common ground and coming to a solution. I think that's the beauty of it, is that the students are teaching us through their navigating these problems how we can solve them.
I'm betting, Erica, in your work at the Refugee Development Center there in Lansing, you see a lot of teen refugees. They've been forced to take on and shoulder adult-level responsibilities as they journey to the United States. How do the kids react to the idea of playing a game, if you will, for fun and being together around serious adult issues like armed conflict or environmental degradation?
Yeah, I would say that one of the most wonderful things that we've seen in this program is watching the sparks light up in kids' eyes and really feeling like their ideas are respected and valued and that they have a voice. So if anything, it's the ability to give voice to these students. And in a lot of ways, that's empowering. They feel really valued and respected and feel like they have contributions to give, and they're not the problem. Often we look at refugee coupled with the word problem, and in this case, our refugee students are the solutions. They're finding those solutions, and I feel like they have felt that through playing this game, that they feel like a solution. They are the leaders in this. They're the ones teaching us.
Now, is there a chance, if someone is not in the Lansing area, to still be able to access Peace Game?
Well, so Peace Game was originally designed by an educator named John Hunter. And so there is a worldpeacegame.org website that you can go to learn more about it. And our Peace Game is a variation of that. And a lot of people around the world really are utilizing this method in a way that makes sense for their students to teach kids about how to come to peaceful solutions and really learn from the kids. So, yeah, you can check out worldpeacegame.org to learn more.
Erica Brown-Binion is Executive Director of the Refugee Development Center in Lansing. You'll find her essay on the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org. Erica, great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on the Next Idea.
It was wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
One of the core elements of our identity is our accent. But we here in the Midwest tend to believe we don't have an accent. Growing up in Ferndale, I would feel a tinge of envy whenever I heard someone from the South. Now, that was an accent. We don't have one. Nothing special about the way we speak, or so I thought. Writer Edward McClellan proves otherwise in his new book, How to Speak Midwestern. He's here with us now. Ted, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, great to be back.
Great to have you back. Now, you grew up in Lansing, so you were only an hour or so from where I grew up. Did you also used to think you didn't have an accent?
I did until I took a class in linguistics at the University of Michigan, and I asked somebody who's from New Jersey what she had noticed about the way Michiganders talk. And she said, well, you say can for the word C-A-N, and that – as I later found out, was
hi,
great to be back. An element
great
of what's
to have you back.
Northern
now, you grew up in Lansing,
shift,
so you were only an hour or so from where.
Significant change in English vowel pronunciation in 1,000 years, and it's happening right here in the Midwest.
Interesting.
And another important element is the O sound when you say box or job. Hmm. So those are probably the two strongest elements of what you call the vowel shift.
I grew up saying tomorrow because my mother is from Guelph, Ontario. But then I realized everybody around me says tomorrow. So
tomorrow.
I did get that tomorrow from my mother. And then now, you just don't hear that in your own head. Well, this is really interesting stuff to talk about. So let's take a listen to an example of a Midwest accent that's not you and it's not me. Here's Michael Moore as he narrates his film Roger and Me.
I got in the car and drove about an hour south of Flint to Detroit, to the world headquarters of General Motors. My mission was a simple one, to convince Roger Smith to spend a day with me in Flint and meet some of the people who were losing their jobs.
Now, you know, Ted, if I was sitting in a bar with Michael Moore, I wouldn't think there was anything going on. But when I hear that clip, good Lord. So
sure.
Kind of break it down. What are we hearing here?
Well, the first is the nasality. That's definitely a hallmark of Midwestern speech. And as I write in the book, if you want to speak Midwestern, the first thing to do is pretend the lower half of your jaw doesn't exist. Make everything come out of the top of your head through your nose.
You're right.
And that's exactly what he's doing. And the second was, as I talked about before, the way he says jobs and I got in the car. So those he has two very strong Midwestern elements in that clip.
It's pretty hilarious when you think about that so many of us from this neck of the woods say, I don't have an accent. But doesn't everyone think they don't have an accent?
Well, I did speak to a linguist who did his PhD at the University of Michigan, and he said that Michiganders in particular are insistent that we don't have accents. And when he was going out doing his fieldwork, people were very puzzled by why he could possibly be interested in the way people from Michigan talk. And I think some of that comes from the fact that starting in the 1920s, the leading expert on English pronunciation was a professor at Hiram College in Ohio. And he introduced as standard English a lot of elements of Midwestern speech, such as pronouncing your R's. If you go back and listen to old actors or actresses such as Katharine Hepburn, and she sort of had that high-toned mid-Atlantic accent, which almost sounded English. And that really started to go out of style starting in the 30s and the 40s and 50s. And so Midwesterners started to think of themselves as being the standard. But, you know, as the Northern Cities vowel shift has advanced, I think it actually has made us more distinct from the rest of the country.
Fascinating. You know, years ago, and really there's still some who subscribe to this today, broadcasters were trained to speak in that Midwestern accent because
sure.
It was seen as very neutral,
right.
You know, fit everywhere. Is that why?
Yeah, it was the professor in Ohio, and he was consulted by NBC to write the manual for standard English pronunciation. And, of course, this was at a time when the Midwest had more economic and political power than it does now. You know, Cleveland could say half of the population of North America is within 500 miles of Cleveland. So it really was considered the center, the middle of the standard of things.
We note that blacks and whites have the biggest difference in speech in the Midwest. Why is that?
Well, because of segregation. Residential segregation was stronger here than really in any part of the country. So when blacks moved up from the South, they lived in isolated neighborhoods where they had no social or professional interaction with whites. So there's a bigger gap between white and black accents in the Midwest than anywhere else. Although they say that in younger generations, there's been the development of what's called a black scent, in which speakers will pick up some of the vowel sounds. I listened to a clip of Common, who's a rapper from Chicago, and he talked about winning an Oscar. So he was sort of doing that fronted O sound. Although the totality of his speech, he still has Southern elements in there, and you would not say he has a Chicago accent, but there are elements now.
So the training was important. And actually, you kind of mentioned that mid-Atlantic accent or the transatlantic accent. And if I'm not mistaken, that was actually developed by a Canadian linguist, and it was taught to the movie stars. So they had that idea and that whole kind of upper crust kind of English, but not exactly. British received pronunciation and American English mixed together. But
well,
you're right.
I listened to a speech by William McKinley, who was from Ohio, and even he talked that way.
Interesting.
There's never been a greater challenge for America.
Yeah. There's nothing like listening to really old classic radio dramas, and I love to do that, to realize how we have shifted, even in something as the name of a city. In early dramas, there was one called Romance of the Ranchos, and it was about the development of California. And they inevitably talk about Los Angeles. You never, absolutely, the announcers and here in Los Angeles. And so in the 30s, even into the 40s, you know, it was not what they would probably laugh at the way we say Los Angeles today. So,
So
it goes to show that this is a very fluid thing.
Yeah, well, one thing I definitely learned is that every generation has its own sound, just like every generation has its own slang. Accents are always shifting and changing. You know, in Chicago, you'll hear more the what you call the classic Chicago accent as it was parodied by the superfans. You'll hear that more among older speakers. And I think that education and social mobility have led to a lot of accent leveling everywhere. And one thing, and this is true of the Midwest and everywhere, you'll hear the local accents are going to be strongest among white people who work in jobs that don't require a lot of contact with people outside the region, say maybe police and firefighters and tradesmen, and who've lived in the region their entire lives.
Before you go, let's talk about some words that make us uniquely Midwestern. Now, we all know about the pop versus soda thing, but what other words are just ours?
Well, I can give you some Michigan words. Well, how about troll? You know what a troll is?
To me, a troll is, well, I'm thinking of somebody who lives under the bridge, who's a Lower Peninsula.
Exactly. Yeah, who lives under the Mackinac Bridge.
Yeah. Of course, now in the internet age, we've got trolling and trolls have a different meaning, but
right.
I grew up with that sense. So that's a Michigan slant on that word.
Where do you go to buy your beer and your potato chips?
The party store.
The party store. That's uniquely Michigan.
Ha!
adding an S, you know, we're going to Kroger's, we're going to Kmart's.
That's okay. So Michigan.
Yes, and that supposedly came from the fact that if you went to work for Ford, you went to work at Mr. Ford's. And so people added S's to all their other business institutions. Okay, I got a note here. Talk about Punchki.
Oh, yes. Punchki, absolutely.
Right. That's all over the Midwest. That's the Polish Mardi Gras. There's the Punchki eating contest in Hamtramck. So somebody ate 23 in 15 minutes.
Wow.
And then there's the hot dog with chili and mustard on it.
Our Coney Island.
Yeah, that's right. That's a Michigan, uniquely Michigan phrase.
There's so much interesting stuff that you'll read as you look through Ted's book, How to Speak Midwestern. You go, oh, my goodness. And so, I mean, we could just go on like this forever. It's a fascinating book. And I know you've got a series of appearances all around the state coming up, which is easy to get the schedule. Just go to Facebook and search for How to Speak Midwestern, and the schedule will all be there. And fun book. It's always fun talking linguistics and kind of reminding ourselves that, yes, we do have a spiffy accent. Dan McClellan, it's great talking with you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was an idea Governor Snyder presented in his State of the State speech last January. Create an advisory commission, people from business, nonprofits, philanthropy, and government. The task? Figure out the best ways to update Michigan's infrastructure, our roads, bridges, water and sewer systems, our energy and communication systems. The 21st Century Infrastructure Commission, as it was named, was ordered to complete its assessment by year's end. Well, they did. Today, the commission is out with its report, setting infrastructure goals for Michigan for the next 30 to 50 years. Here with us is Evan Weiner, the COO and Executive Vice President of Edward C. Levy & Company, and he's chairman of the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission. Welcome.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be here.
Your report makes it so clear that virtually every aspect of life in Michigan is affected by the infrastructure you've been studying, for better or for worse, isn't it?
That's true. That's true. The things that we need and use every day from infrastructure does impact everybody every day. You think about it, right? The water you use, the transportation that you take to and from work, the communication devices that we need, like we're using today, from rail to airports, to communication, to the water you use. Everything, every day is related to having good infrastructure.
And I was real struck by the way that your report, your committee's report, indicates that there's such an overarching problem, the fact that infrastructure is siloed in Michigan, all these agencies and commissions and systems and utilities and broadband providers. So it's small wonder one hand doesn't often know what the other hand is doing. What's the call to action to fix this?
Right. So when we studied the infrastructure groupings, the different types of infrastructure, what we learned was that we have an awful lot of different agencies that are responsible for infrastructure today. And when you think about it, it makes sense because 50 or 100 years ago, there were localities and local folks that had to take care of their infrastructure. So we have over 1,000 wastewater systems. We have over 1,300 municipal water systems, 700 transportation agencies, and so forth. So the commission broke up into groups to study different areas of infrastructure. One group studying water, one studying the transportation networks, others studying energy or communication. And we all did best practice analysis. We came up with one single thought as it related to how we could provide better infrastructure coordination. And we found answers in places like the UK or Canada, New Zealand, Australia. And what we found was that those places that had the very best low-cost effective infrastructure had asset management and coordinated planning. And they had essentially a consul group of subject matter experts reporting into senior government that made recommendations that allowed for them to look specifically at all of the different infrastructure types and how they work together or don't work together. So asset management is a critical piece, and that's actually studying the performance, condition, and level of service of the infrastructure that we're counting on. And coordinated planning, meaning that you looked at projects holistically. You looked at all the infrastructure types when planning new projects.
And a council to oversee all of this.
Michigan Infrastructure Council is the idea, and that's absolutely right. It would be there to provide a governor, the administration, legislators, community leaders with ideas on how to most effectively, efficiently provide what everybody really wants, safe, reliable, cost-effective, and efficient infrastructure. And it would be a great asset for the entire state, for a little local town or a municipality, a township, for this council to help build an asset data system that could be eventually developed into information to help these small communities and large communities organize regionally their infrastructure projects so it matches with the economic development and prosperity for all in the regions. So it's really a great tool that can be used that ultimately will feed into this council and allow the council to make sure that we're doing things intelligently and cost-effectively.
And today's report is packed with great recommendations for water and transportation and energy and communications, as you say, breaking it into those four groups. I think most everybody reading these will say, absolutely, we need to, you know, ensure public and environmental health and have adequate resources and cleaner energy sources and improved broadband access. These are all great goals, and they're overdue. But here's the rub. Money. When I saw the report pointing to this huge infrastructure investment gap, more than $60 billion over the next 20 years, and so Michigan has to raise the spending of infrastructure by another $4 billion a year to close that gap?
Well, when you add it all up, Cindy, that's exactly right. But the Infrastructure Commission didn't provide the exact funding. What we did is we provided a menu of options, some of which legally we can't do in the state of Michigan. We talked about P3s, private-public partnership. We talk about infrastructure banks. We talk about social impact bonds and other smart ways to take a problem that exists today and, in some cases, spread those payments out over many, many years. With today's interest rates and the time value of money and compounding interest, you know, one can make an investment today and take your time in paying for it. So we can't get too nervous about the money. What we have to do is get the engineering done, prioritize the things we need, and then tackle them one at a time between user pay, different kinds of funding mechanisms, and different kinds of financing mechanisms. We can get started and start to tackle this thing. The point is that it's going to take us a long time to get it done. But if we don't decide to start today, it's going to be a heck of a lot more expensive tomorrow.
So to be able to do some of these things, as you say, they're not even kind of legally set up yet to do that.
Right.
So that's a challenge to the legislature.
That's right. There's a call to action for the legislature. Absolutely. But the menu of options are there, and the kinds of financing available to us today is there, and some of the basic kinds of ways that communities raise funds at a local level, all those recommendations are in the report. So yes, it's a big number. But if we start tackling it today, it's kind of like paying off a mortgage. And when you look out 30 years, it's amazing what you can get done.
And I look at the ways of investing and, as you say, private investments. So you're saying these P3s, these public-private partnerships could be a big part of this?
Yes, those can make sense. It has to be cost-effective. P3s can be used. They have been used in Michigan already. Of course, there's the bridge, which is a P3. That we're hopefully going to build. But the governor was talking today about the lighting system in and around Detroit. That P3 was used to build these new, beautiful, LED, cost-effective and efficient lights for our freeway system in and around southeastern Michigan. So there's ways we can take that kind of model and put it to work.
When I see the call for state funding, I have to think of what it took to get Lansing to come up with a way to find $1.2 billion for road repairs. What a torturous path that was. So, you know, wondering about the realistic prospects of Lansing really chipping in a big chunk of that $4 billion every year to close that gap.
Right. Well, I think we have to be thankful that the legislature did act and did make some long-term commitments for transportation in Michigan. What we know, of course, today is that it's not enough. And so the legislature will have to face the facts that it's what the people want. We went out to talk to the people. And you know what? The average motorist or the average citizen, the average water consumer, right, phone user, electricity ratepayer, they basically had the same message. No matter where we were in the state, they said, yes, we want to pay for safe, reliable, cost-effective, and efficient infrastructure, but we want to know what we're paying for. So I think the people are willing to pay on a monthly basis a sum that makes sense for them to get what we need to have the kind of infrastructure that our kids and grandchildren deserve. The legislature will reflect on what the people want and hopefully have the ability to help pay for this going forward.
Would that Michigan Infrastructure Council, having this more streamlined and tied together, would that provide a bigger punch, if you will, in trying to go after this federal money?
I think so. It would provide two things. One, remember, we said there's 3,300 entities that are working hard to provide infrastructure to their residents and citizens of Michigan. This council would help give them the tools so that they can provide data and information into a system so we can look at infrastructure holistically. That information and what the needs and wants of these individual communities and or regions can be reflected through this commission and be much more, if you will, effective to let the legislators, the governor, our leaders know how to prioritize action in Washington to get more federal dollars, but also to prioritize the spending so that in a coordinated manner, we get good value for the citizens of Michigan. Look, we've all had the experience of having the road paved in front of our business or home or one of the main thoroughfares we drive on every day. And just about the time it's finished, what happens? Along comes, you know, a utility, et cetera, and so forth that gets cut up and cut up and cut up. We've got to get organized so that when projects are done, all infrastructure entities know the project's coming, they're coordinated, well-developed, and the public gets what they want in the long term.
Evan Weiner, chairman of Governor Snyder's 21st Century Infrastructure Commission, out with its report on this day. Evan, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for taking the time.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. The Magic Flute, one of the most famous works of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. What you might not know is Mozart finished and premiered that opera in the very final months of his life. Mozart died 225 years ago this day. He was only 35. The cause of his death is a medical question that has endured as long as his music. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here now helping us unwind the medical mystery. That vibrant music certainly doesn't give any clues that Mozart was truly at the end of his life.
No, because the Magic Flute is perhaps his happiest and most fanciful body of music. It's wonderful.
And when I stop and think, even by 1791 standards, wasn't 35 really premature? I mean, I understand back in the Dark Ages, 35, you were very old.
Yeah.
But by 1791, that was very premature, wasn't it?
Yeah, but people did die at a young age. So there are epidemiological studies of the rates of death in Vienna, for example, at that era. And the average age for a man was about 45, 46 years of age, and for a woman, about 54, 55 years of age. You know, there were a lot more things that could kill you back then. They still exist, but we can treat them now.
We have things to do with that. And he really did keep working right up until the very end.
Yeah. You know, he also kept partying. He was a notorious party animal and he drank a lot, but he just worked all the time. And when you look at his body of work, how much there was. Now, of course, he started as a little boy.
Right.
His first symphony was when he was quite young, I think 5 or 6 years of age. But it's just incredible when you see how much he wrote. He must have always been writing or thinking about music.
And I know in your piece for PBS, you noticed the Magic Flute. You pointed to the Clarinet Concerto in A, the Requiem in D minor, all of this in just those final weeks.
Right. He was working on the famous Requiem, which is haunting and beautiful to this day. And he actually died before it was completed.
Now, anyone who saw Peter Schaeffer's play Amadeus or the 1984 film version of it is saying, well, what's the medical mystery? He was poisoned by his rival Antonio Salieri, who looks a lot like actor F. Murray Abraham. So a lot of poetic license there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful fictional plot. And the play, by the way, is quite different than the movie, so it's worth seeing both. But that was just a fictional story. Now, there were rumors even back then that Mozart was poisoned. A few weeks before he died, he felt ill and he told his wife, Constanza, I must have been poisoned. He retracted that when he started to feel better. But only a week after his death, a Berlin newspaper reported he was poisoned. Mm-hmm. And then these rumors about Salieri came up. In fact, Carl Beethoven, one of Beethoven's sons, spread the malicious rumor that he had heard Salieri admit to the murder on his deathbed. That's complete fiction.
This didn't happen. The internet of 2016 with the fake news sites.
Absolutely.
Well, what kind of symptoms had Mozart been experiencing leading up? When did he start being
ill?
Well,
we know the symptoms he experienced a few weeks before he died because his sister-in-law was taking care of him, Sophie Heibel. His wife was out of town. They were having marital issues. And we know that he had edema, swelling of the limbs, the gut, the face, because you're retaining body fluid. He had a high fever and he had a rash of some kind. On the other hand, we know he wasn't terribly short of breath, so the edema wasn't that bad because he was singing parts of his Requiem not only to the man who was copying it down, Alfred Sussmeier, not Antonio Salieri, is in the movie. And he invited friends the night before he died to sing various parts of the Requiem. So that suggests a great deal of energy and mental acuity.
So what was the diagnosis at the time?
Well, you know, Diagnoses of the late 18th century are problematic because it's a completely different language. It's a completely different understanding of medicine. And his physician said he had acute miliary fever. Now, what that is a very high fever with these little rashes that look like millet seeds, hence miliary. They may be bruises like petechiae, little blood clots, or they may be an actual rash. But we don't know what he actually died of. And then as was the custom of the day, it wasn't just because he was poor. Most commoners were buried in a common grave in Vienna at that time by order of the emperor. It was only the royalty that got their own cemetery plot. Well, we can't really do an autopsy or a postmortem because he's in a in a hole with a lot of other bones.
But interestingly, you say in hindsight there have been a lot of different diagnoses. How many in the years since have been offered?
Well, by last count in the medical literature, now there may be quite a few more in the hospital down the street, but 136 different diagnoses have been made.
Ranging from what to what?
Oh, from mercury poisoning and tuberculosis to my favorite, trichinosis from eating raw pork.
Okay.
Syphilis. Scarlet fever, you name it, he's been diagnosed with it.
So in your view, what's the best answer to that question of why did Mozart die at such a young age?
In my view, I always comment on other people's retrospective diagnoses because I know you'll always be proven wrong in the end.
Who's got the best one?
The one I enjoyed the most was a group of epidemiologists from Vienna, London, and Amsterdam. They looked at the death records of Vienna for that few-week period in 1791, as well as a corresponding period at the end of 1790 and following 1792. They looked at all the deaths of men and women, and they found that there was a real bump, an increase of young men dying just at the time that Mozart died. And there was also an epidemic going around Vienna at that time that matched many of the symptoms that he had. So these doctors decided that he had a streptococcal infection, strep, which then caused failure of the kidneys, which would explain the edema. And then he went into kidney failure and he died. I like that one because it's so clever the way they found that information.
That's some pretty good sleuthing.
Very good sleuthing.
And the fever, it all kind of fits.
Kind of, sort of. So, yeah.
But as you note in your piece for PBS NewsHour, it's a fun parlor game for medical detectives, but it does not change a single thing about the way we regard his music.
No, no. In fact, today, which is a sad day for music lovers, we should celebrate the wonderful music he left us with.
University of Michigan medical historian Dr. Howard Markell, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.